General Gordon really is an extraordinary character and well worth having a full focus on at a Reformation Society meeting. The most extraordinary example of the clash of cultures and the clash of religions in Sudan came about in the latter half of the 19th century. The legacy of the English Christian general Charles Gordon, or Gordon Pasha as he's best remembered in Sudan, and of the Arab Muslim the Mahdi, Muhammad Ahmed ibn Abdullah. It continues to influence Sudan to this day. Really, it's a country that's torn between the Mahdi and the faith of General Gordon. General Charles Gordon is an extraordinary person because he was, without a doubt, the most famous general of Victorian England. And he was also the most devout, dedicated, independent-minded evangelical Christian that they probably ever had as a general in the British Army. He's also remarkable that he never commanded a British army. And yet, even though he was almost always commanding foreigners, he managed to accomplish tremendous things. And he was considered an incredible risk and a very rebellious person by the government. The governments could never deal with him. Presidents, prime ministers, I should say, would give him orders and he'd treat them as a suggestion. He regularly went against the orders of the government. The governments were furious, and in the end he brought down the British government. And we'll look at that just now. Charles Gordon, whose life and death was destined to have such a great impact on the history of Sudan, was born in England 1833. He was the fourth son of a royal artillery officer who rose to be a lieutenant general. Charles was described as a resourceful and aggressive youngster with a keen eye and with a fiery temper for injustice. He entered the military academy at age 16, and at 19 he began his training for the Royal Engineers. Now, the Royal Engineers was the premier elite professional corps in the 19th century. It was the engineers who carried out reconnaissance work, who led storming parties, who demolished obstacles in assaults, who carried out rearguard actions and retreats and other hazardous tasks. So they were often the first in and the last out. Gordon saw action in the Crimean War in southern Russia, where he gained a reputation for fearless scouting of enemy positions, under fire in the front line, always returning with accurate field sketches and useful intelligence. Gordon was critical of the general lack of offensive spirit, and he was disgusted by those whose zeal was less than his own. He wrote of the indescribable excitement of war, and how he enjoyed it amazingly. He is mentioned in dispatches, and after the war, he was appointed assistant commissioner to a new international commission to survey the new Russian-Turkish boundary. And for 3 years, this preoccupied him in Bessarabia and Armenia. Obviously, he had to be a very good engineer to be trusted with things like border delineations and map work. After this, Captain Gordon was sent to China, where he reconnoitred literally 400 miles of the Great Wall. And he also began a charitable fund for paupers. He contracted smallpox and began to seriously consider eternal things. At about this time, Tin Wang, or the Heavenly King, as he's called, or he called himself, Tin Wang inaugurated a new dynasty of perpetual peace by starting a vicious civil war. So it's not just in the 20th century that people in the name of peace would launch wars, obviously they've been doing this for a long time. Hundreds of thousands died at the hands of these Taiping rebels. Many were beheaded, crucified, or buried alive. Yet these so-called freedom fighters received widespread support from British liberals. Again, some things don't seem to change. There's always a gullible Christian out there who seems to want to believe in the best of these violent so-called freedom fighters who were nothing of the sort. Some missionaries wrote ecstatic accounts of sober, God-fearing Wangs, which is what the Taiping rebel leaders were called, and yet they were outrageous, brutal, vicious murderers, and yet there were missionaries who were suckered into believing their propaganda for a while. This is where the Taiping Rebellion spread. It took the heart of China, spreading over the whole center of China, even as far as Shanghai and Nanking. In 1863, Captain Gordon was now appointed major, and he has made a command of a Chinese mercenary force, which was optimistically named the Ever Victorious Army, or the EVA. Now, that's not the name he gave it, that's the name that was given before he became commander. Now, the British had a reason to send their soldiers as effectively mercenaries. They still had the commission, they were still answerable to the British government, but they would be, instead of sending a British army to some places, they might send an officer who was meant to help train. That's sort of what the Americans try to do now, with sending some Green Beret unit in to help train some ally to hopefully affect the result that they want. And in fact, that's what South Africa did too. We had people like Colonel Breitenbach going into Angola and recruiting a whole lot of FNLA soldiers and turning them into 3-2 battalion, or training UNITA soldiers. And we had the Rhodesian SAS training RENAMO to be more effective in fighting the communist Mozambicans. The principle is that it's going to cost you less and there's less risk involved in sending one or two specialists to go and train a lot of local people to do an ongoing job. And there's no doubt good political reasons for that too. So effectively, this is just another example that the first command that Gordon ever had was of Chinese. He never commands British troops. And Gordon took to this task of suppressing the extraordinarily successful Taiping rebels with ingenuity. There's no doubt the Taiping rebels were better soldiers than the ones he had. And Gordon turned the enemy's two greatest assets to his own advantage. Because the Taipings were better fighters than his own Chinese troops, he spared the prisoners' lives and enlisted the captured Taiping into his own ever-victorious army. And the many intricate waterways which serve as obstacles to advances, Gordon turned into routes for supply and for attack. So instead of seeing them as obstacles, he saw them as channels. And he utilized a large flotilla of small ships to transport his artillery and his infantry down the canals to outflank the Taipings and bring his own guns to bear on their positions where they didn't expect it to take place. He utilized a large flotilla, as you can see here, some of the rivers that were utilized and some of the movements. Absolutely extraordinary what he managed to do in a very short space of time. Gordon conceived it to be the duty of a commanding officer to personally lead critical assaults. This he did with calm courage and with competence. In 16 months he planned and executed 16 major offensives, capturing or destroying most of the Taipings and their weaponry. That's just a phenomenal achievement to be able to do something like that. Amidst the battles, he rescued many an orphan. At the height of the Khun Son battle, he is seen carrying a naked urchin who was later educated at Gordon's expense and who grew up to be a senior police officer in Shanghai. So right from the beginning, you can see he had a very charitable heart. Gordon succeeded in defeating the rebellion by aggressive leadership and indirect tactics, with very little loss to his own forces. He earned the reputation of being extraordinarily tough. He worked day and night. He's a man of courage, resolution, and when necessary, he was ruthless. He ended up as a marshal in the Imperial Chinese Army, but he refused literally a roomful of gold as a reward. The emperor gave him a roomful of gold and he scorned it. He refused any payments beyond his regular British Army pay. He returned to Britain in 1865 to England as a celebrity, and he was lionized by the press as Chinese Gordon. And that confuses many people that he is called Chinese Gordon when he's most associated with Sudan in our mind. His father's death in the year of his return to England revived his spiritual interests, and it was from 1865 that he dated his true conversion to Christ. Before this, he wrote that he had a belief that Jesus was the Son of God, and he used to have feelings of deep depression on account of his faults. But now he could write, "I know Jesus is my Savior. God has made me count the cost and conclude that his service should be all. The fruits of the Spirit could be had only by abiding in Christ." Gordon gave himself wholeheartedly to Christian service in his community. He visited poor families, sick people, lonely people, whom he befriended. For the rest of his life, he was involved in the relief of the sick, the suffering, the poor, particularly homeless orphans. And his family mansion became a mission house. He ran a free school from his home where every evening he taught reading, writing, arithmetic, and history. There was also cricket, chess, cheerful hymns. The scuttlers from the slums normally were filthy and were washed by General Gordon, but we had to hose them down first. He planted the freshly cleaned clothed boy in front of a mirror, and Gordon would say, "Just as you see a new boy on the outside, I want you to be new inside as well." Gordon gave him a home, food, clothes, teaching, and knowledge of God and of God's word. And he also helped him find employment. After 8 years of such inner city missionary activity in England, Gordon was invited to replace Samuel Baker as governor of Equatoria, which was the southernmost province of Sudan, which is where we've done most of our missionary work. His mission would be to establish order, suppress the slave trade, in over 200,000 square miles of thorn shrub and swamp. So this was quite a task. And again, no British army being given to him. He has just been given an assignment where he's expected to utilize local assets. He was getting next to no support from Britain itself. And no doubt the British government didn't know what to do with him when he was in England. That's why he had so much time on his hand for missions. He was the kind of person they shipped off to far places. Like the Moses who despised the riches of Egypt, Gordon refused the £10,000 a year salary which the Khedive of Egypt offered him. Gordon accepted the governorship for only £2,000, saying, I don't need £10,000, £2,000 will do just fine. This contributed to the growing belief that Chinese Gordon was not quite sane. I mean, who would turn down a room full of gold and turn down a higher salary? But that was Gordon. And Gordon was going in now to tackle the slave trade, a hideous trade in slaves that the Arabs had been involved in since the 7th century. This is the reality. Something like 140 million Africans fell victim to the slave trade over the 14 centuries of Islamic slavery. Sudan at that time was a colony of Egypt, and Egypt in turn was owing allegiance to the Turkish Empire. The Khedive Ismail was an Albanian Muslim who ruled Egypt. He himself was a slave owner on a gigantic scale, as were most of his relatives, his friends, his ministers of state. But slavery was bad for the Khedive's image in Europe, because Europe is where most of his investments came from. Remember, at that stage, France and Britain were busy building the Suez Canal, which is a massive investment and project. So, for political reasons, the Khedive, Ismail, instructed Gordon to stop the slave trade in Sudan. So in this way, he could enjoy the services of innumerable slaves in Egypt, at the same time earn the reputation of being an enlightened leader who opposed the slave trade. As governor of Equatoria, Gordon soon learned that almost all of his Egyptian soldiers had been sent to Sudan as punishment. They were stunningly unmotivated, and they were ill-clothed, ill-fed, unpaid conscripts who were never allowed to leave lest they desert. And so with such unpromising troops, Gordon would suppress the slave trade, explore the Great Lakes, and introduce law and order to Equatoria. The possession of slaves in Sudan was legal. It was the traffic in slaves that Gordon had to suppress. Slavery was easy money. Some Arab adventurer could obtain loans, boats, slave raiders, and Khartoum sail up the Nile, and in partnership with some cooperative local chief, they could raid a few villages at dawn. A few people would be shot or speared, the rest would be captured, the elders would be tortured to reveal where their ivory was hidden, and adults were secured with a shaziba, or a heavy forked pole, which rested on the shoulders, and the head was secured by a crossbar, hands were tied to the pole. Of the few survivors who reached Khartoum, females were allocated to concubines or domestic service. Most of the males became laborers or servants. The lucky ones became bazingas, or slave soldiers, and they would carry out slave raids on others. And the unlucky males were castrated for household service, and this operation, performed in unsanitary conditions without any anesthetics, was often fatal. That was the slave trade. Byproducts of the slave trade were cattle and ivory captured or bartered, which were carried by the slaves. Now, the average slaver could aim on capturing 400 to 500 slaves, which were worth about £5 or £6 each. But he could have them carry 20,000 pounds of ivory worth £4,000 in Khartoum. So you can see the slave trade wasn't that profitable without the ivory trade. And so ivory and slavery went together. And the stinking, thriving, fly-swarming city of Khartoum prospered on the twin trades of slavery and ivory. There was hardly an official in Sudan who was not involved in these trades. It would have been hard to find a household in Khartoum so poor that it didn't own at least one slave. Even the most pious and humane Muslim were unable to see why the Christians made such a fuss about slavery. It might be wrong to enslave Muslims, went the arguments, but the very economics of Sudan requires a constant flow of fresh slaves, and the vast majority of these were pagan blacks. Could any reasonable man deny that the life of a Negro as a slave in Egypt, Turkey or Syria was infinitely preferable to his life in Equatoria or the Congo, where it was poor, nasty, brutish, and short? So that's the common rationalization in defense of the Islamic slave trade, which is even in writing. Gordon's first action against the slave trade was to nationalize the ivory trade, which denied slavers much of their profit. Then he closed the Nile River to slavers. This, unfortunately, had the unforeseen result of immeasurably increasing the sufferings of the slaves, because instead of being crammed like sardines into boats down the Nile, now the slaves were marched across the pitiless desert. So Gordon improved communications down the Nile, multiplied the military outposts throughout Equatoria. He set about introducing the rule of law. It was a very personal administration. Justice was swift. Criminals were flogged. It was effective. It was popular with the people. However, it only worked because of Gordon's impartiality. With anyone less fair and less conscientious, it would have doubtless been abused. Gordon's was the first example of a foreign rule which could be fair, conscientious, and incorruptible. In fact, that's about the first time they've experienced incorrupt and fair governing of any sort. At Rajal, there was over 100 armed men of the Nyam Nyam tribe who were reportedly occasional cannibals. They surrounded Gordon, and after drumming all night, they advanced threateningly on him. Gordon drew two guns and ordered them, "Now go." And they went. They left him alone. On another occasion, a mob of hostile Bari people threatened Gordon. As the witch doctors seemed to be performing some cursing ceremony on him, Gordon fired a shot in the ground beside them. This ended the ceremony and the threat. Gradually, movement became easier in Equatoria. The people began to see that they could receive justice even against the governor's own servants. When Gordon began his work in Equatoria, its only exports were ivory and slaves. Slavers operated with impunity. A healthy young woman could be purchased from her parents for just a packet of needles. By the time Gordon left, the respect for human life had once again been returned to Equatoria. As the slave routes had now moved across the desert to Bahr el-Ghazal, Gordon wrote to the Khedive requesting the position of Governor General of the whole of Sudan, and this was granted. So now he's no longer just Governor of Equatoria, but of all Sudan. And Gordon's Sudan was 1,600 miles long and about 600 miles wide. His first task as Governor General was to see the whole of Sudan and to be seen by it. Within 5 months, Gordon rode over 5,000 miles by camel across scorching desert sand, stony steppes, wooded uplands, steamy swamps. And you can see some of the places that he would have traveled around. And all by camel. Can you imagine what a journey that must have been, rocking up and down the camel. He used thoroughbred racing camels capable of long journeys at an average of 7 miles an hour. He owned a team of 5 camels so as not to wear them out, and he read books while riding them at a trot. Sort of reminds you of John Wesley reading while he walked and reading while he rode on horseback. The desert strengthened the tendencies of him towards asceticism and mysticism, which already were quite strong within him. As others before him had been prepared for their life work in the desert, we can only think of examples like Moses, so too Gordon became even more spiritually attuned. Gordon enjoyed the drama of swooping down like an avenging angel upon some lethargic garrison of a remote desert outpost, leaning forward in his high saddle, legs pressed on the camel shoulders, just as he's depicted on his famous statue, which was later erected in Khartoum. During his camel tour of Sudan, Gordon suppressed a revolt. The robber chieftains of Bahr el-Ghazal cowered into submission. He neutralized the largest and most dangerous slave trader, Suleiman Zabir. He disbanded half his slave army and took the rest into his army, all without firing a shot. I mean, imagine the character of a person who could ride into a slave trader's camp, persuade his army to join him, put the slave trader against the wall and have him shot, all without drawing a sword or his revolver. And then he'd march out with the slave trader's army now on his side, setting the captives free. That's just the most extraordinary achievement. Gordon succeeded in breaking the back of the slave trade in Sudan. And he did this with prayer, with pressure, with persuasion, and with his overwhelming personality. These experiences convinced him that there were no limits to what could be achieved by audacity and by faith in God. In one of his writings, Gordon rebuked Christians for lacking in self-denial and devotion. A man must give up everything, understand everything for Christ. Gordon was ruthless with incompetent officials. He sacked many lethargic and corrupt officials. He created momentous upheavals, disruptions in administration. When he investigated the prisons, he found them to be dens of injustice, with many prisoners detained for years without trial. Gordon somehow found the time to look into every case, and he set a lot of captives free. Corruption, false testimony, incompetence had led to many miscarriages of justice, which he now endeavored to reverse. He summarily had a notorious murderer hung, and the city was a lot quieter for that. He had a man hanged for castrating a slave. Many unjustly detained people who had never been to trial were released. In just 2 months, Gordon captured 12 slave caravans. One of these, after crossing 500 miles of desert, had only 90 of the original 400 slaves surviving. Few were over 16 years old. Some of the girls had babies and there were many small children. He caught many of his own officials and soldiers involved in the slave trade. Gordon ordered that the governor of any district through which a captured slave train was proved to have passed should forfeit 3 months' pay. So when a Royal Navy vessel captured a large slave ship offshore of Massawa, Gordon solemnly handed over 3 months of his own salary, because that was technically within his jurisdiction. At Chaka, he expelled 100 slave dealers, 4 of whom were proven guilty of a massacre, and they were shot. 14 slaves were rescued from a small party of 3 slavers whom Gordon had flogged and dismissed. To tighten the blockade on Bahr el-Ghazal, Gordon authorized the Bagadra tribe to arrest any slaver. So he sort of deputized them. Financial problems in Cairo precipitated a change in government. An ousted Kedev Ismail was replaced by Kedev Tewik, who is now Turk. Instead of the Albanian Kedev, now they had a Turkish Kedev. And this led to Gordon being replaced as Governor General of Sudan. Yet, as Gordon left, he left behind a transformed Sudan. He had abolished the Kobah, which was the whipping of the soles of the feet for not paying your taxes. Imagine if you had people having their soles of their feet whipped in South Africa for not paying their taxes. He stamped out corruption. He had freed many who had been unjustly imprisoned. He had freed many slaves. He had also remitted back taxes, and he had provided piped water for Khartoum for the first time. He was popular in Equatoria as the man who had at least temporarily freed them from the Muslim North. However, he was resented, although he was respected, by the Arab North. His prestige was much higher than his popularity. Most Sudanese value the courage of a warrior very highly, and Gordon's courage was unquestioned. They might have resented having a Christian govern them, but they respected his piety and respected his devotion. They may have deplored his attacks on the slave trade, but they also appreciated his zeal, his energy, and his integrity. Gordon was admired more for what he was than for what he had done. It wasn't that they liked what he had done as much as admired how he did it. Now, while Gordon was leaving Sudan, another leader was living as a hermit on an island of Aba, about 200 miles up the White Nile from Khartoum. And in May 1881, at the age of 38, Muhammad Ahmed Ibn Abdullah proclaimed himself the Mahdi, which is basically the Muslim military messiah, prophesied. This was after years spent in prayer, fasting, Quranic study, and the contemplation of the decay of Islam. And he was the one who launched the Sufi sect. The Sufi sect, which predominates in Sudan, widely believed in the coming of the Mahdi, the expected one, the eschatological figure whose advent foreshadowed the end of the world. And so the Sufi leaders and teachers were galvanized by the proclamation of the Mahdi. And there were teachers known as fakers, and their devilish disciples widely believed that in the year of 1300 of the Hijra, that's 1882 in the Christian calendar, but that's 1300 years after Muhammad's flight from Mecca to Medina, the Mahdi would reveal himself. And by the way, that's where the word faking it comes from, and being a faker. It's because their prophets were known as fakers. in Sudan and the Sufi clan. Like, do you know where the term luck comes from? Luck is a Hindu word. It's the Hindu god of prosperity is Lakshmi. And so British Cockney soldiers in India used to say, good Lakshmi to you, to a person. And after a while, the word lucky entered into English vocabulary because Lakshmi is actually a Hindu god. They pray to you for prosperity. So if, when a person speaks about being lucky or good luck, it's actually harking back to the old Hindu concept. You know, an assassin, the word assassin is also an Arabic term. It's the people who literally assassinate. So the word assassin and assassinate is again another Arabic word from the Arabic terms. The word whore comes from the Quran. It speaks of the 70 whores that are chained to pillars for the men who die in battle in paradise. And so when they speak about 70 virgins, well, the word in the Quran is whores, and it's whores. And that's where the term whores comes from, is from what they now are calling the 70 virgins in paradise. Well, actually, considering that's the etymology of the word whores, interesting. But it just shows how they twist things for the gullible in the West. But a faker is a Muslim prophet. They were the ones who prophesied the Mahdi. So the year 1300 had come. So the Sufi were predisposed to accept the claims of Muhammad Ahmed, who was a member of the Samani order of the Sufis. He came from the west of the Muslim world, not as had been predicted from the east, but otherwise he is everything that the Mahdi should be. He was devout, he was learned, he descended from the Prophet, he carried the sign of a mole on his right cheek. There had been others claimed to be the Mahdi, but none came as close as he did to matching the prophecy. And as the successor of the Prophet, the Mahdi claimed temporal authority over all Muslims, and he claimed the spiritual authority to restore the purity of Islam. He had chosen an opportune time to announce his uprising. There was widespread resentment of the Turkish rule, the foreign rule. Many thousands had been bankrupted by the suppression of the slave trade. The fakers and the dervishes responded to his religious appeal. The river tribes desired the return of the lucrative slave trade. The Baggara nomads were basically against any government, which to them just meant taxes. So they were against any government because governments give taxes. So when the Mahdi forbade the paying of taxes to Khartoum and announced a return to the slave trade, his popularity was assured. With a foundation like that, I'll bring back the slave trade and you won't have to pay any taxes. And they just lined up to support him. Imitating Muhammad, the Mahdi made his Hegira, his retreat, to the Jebel Qadir in the Nuba Mountains of Kordofan, and the Baggara joined him by the thousands, and three punitive expeditions against the Mahdists were annihilated. Those would be expeditions by the Egyptian government, because remember, Sudan's still an Egyptian colony at this stage. And so the rebellion just flourished. Meanwhile, there'd been a military coup in Cairo. There'd been a massacre of Christians in Alexandria. And this led to a British naval bombardment of Alexandria and an expedition under General Wolseley, who was Gordon's lifelong friend. General Wolseley, you might recall, was involved in the Anglo-Boer War, the First Anglo-Boer War. He was involved in the Ashanti campaign. He was involved in Ghana. He was involved also in the very tail end of the Anglo-Zulu War and the capture of King Cetshwayo, for example. So Wolseley was destined to become chief of staff of the whole British army. He was, in later on in life, he became the top British military leader. Well, General Wolseley had led a suppression of the military coup in Cairo and to stop the Muslims from massacring Christian Copts. And on the 13th of September 1882, Wolseley routed the Egyptian army at Tel El Kebir. And this began Britain's occupation of Egypt, which was meant to be brief and only lasted 70 years. It sort of makes you wonder, similarly to a lot of things like what the American army does. You know, we're just going in just for a very short-term goal and are still there years later. Well, during this time, Gordon was promoted to Major General. And he was appointed Commandant General of the forces in the Cape Colony in South Africa. So he came to Cape Town and he had his office in the castle. If you walk through the main gates in the castle, you look to the right, you'll see the stairs running up to the Commandant's office. I've been called on orders to the Commandant's office before, the same office where General Gordon would have been based when he was here. Well, Gordon soon made his strong and unpopular opinions known. The Boers had recently thrashed the British army at Majuba were men after his own heart. They were brave, frugal and pious. As for the natives, they'd been badly treated and promises made to the Zulus had been broken. So he took the Zulu side and the Boer side. So you can imagine how popular he was with the British government. Gordon visited the exiled Zulu king, Keshwe, who at that stage was locked up in the castle. And he allowed him full freedom to walk around the castle walls and gave him a lot of privileges. He spoke to him of spiritual matters and shared the gospel with him very clearly. Neither did Gordon neglect the spiritual welfare of the Boers. He had one of his tracts translated into Dutch, and he distributed quantities around the countryside for God-fearing burghers to study. Gordon's prime responsibility was to settle the Basutu border question, because the Sutus were raiding Free State farmers and cattle and going up the hillsides, and the Sutus asked for Britain to give them protection. They wanted to become a protectorate of Britain so they could keep all the horses that stolen from the Free State farmers, and they tried to use the British crown for that. So during this time, Gordon had dealings with Cecil John Rhodes, who found him an extraordinary man, one who was disinterested in money. Cecil Rhodes had never found a person he couldn't buy, and here was somebody who he could not corrupt. And you can imagine the shock and amazement of Cecil Rhodes to find an incorruptible person. Finally, Gordon resigned, complaining that it was not possible to do anything with such a weak, vacillating government as that in Cape Town. One wonders if things have changed that much. Gordon then took long leave, and he fulfilled his cherished ambition to spend a year of research in the Holy Land. He declared it to be the happiest year of his life. He had a routine of prayer, Bible study, and examining Jerusalem and other historical sites which Jesus administered. He set out to resolve through investigation the site of the crucifixion, the place of the Holy Sepulchre, or the empty tomb, and other biblical issues. And his book, Reflections in Palestine, was to him his most prized achievement. And today, if you go to Israel, they'll show you Gordon's tomb. Well, it's not Gordon's tomb, it's the empty tomb of Christ in the garden. We know it more as the garden tomb, is what he called it. But it's called that because General Gordon identified it. There were the superstitious places which Copts, Orthodox, Catholics through the years had decided this was the place, and they built massive, huge shrines over it so that you couldn't even see the original place. And to this day, there are many people from around the world who go to those sites. But Gordon identified the sites which Protestants have always acknowledged, and that is what's called the Garden Tomb. And he's the one who identified Golgotha, Calvary, which is not what the mystics had identified before. And it looks like his Bible study, his actual research and archaeological excavations proved beyond doubt that Gordon was the one who got it right. Who would have thought some soldier actually trumped all the mystics and professionals of the ages, and all the Protestants in the world today recognize that Gordon's identification of Calvary and of the empty tomb are the correct ones. Well, on September the 8th, 1883, a British Colonel Hicks, who was in command of an Egyptian force of 10,000 unmotivated Egyptian soldiers, marched into Kordofan in search of the Mahdi. And on the 5th of December, his rabble was annihilated along with himself and his officers, and this military disaster placed Khartoum itself at risk. As Britain was occupying Egypt because of the Suez Canal, Britain was now responsible also for Sudan, which it didn't want. However, after Britain's humiliating defeats at the hands of the Zulus in Isandlwana at 1879 and the Boers at Majuba in 1881, the Liberal government wanted to get out of Egypt and stay out of Sudan. Unwilling to send an army to relieve Khartoum, the Prime Minister Gladstone agreed to send General Gordon. This is just typical political moving. This is a cheap move. We sent Gordon, even though he will probably get beheaded and have his body floats down the Nile, but we did the best we could. We sent Gordon. Of course, he didn't have an army. He didn't have a budget. He's just sent out there with his personal adjutant meant to somehow face this mob of 300,000 mad dervishes on the rampage. There were 21,000 Egyptian Sudanese soldiers scattered throughout Sudan under the Egyptian control, but they were confronted by 300,000 dervishes who were following the Mahdi. And now they were armed with modern rifles and artillery, which had been captured from Hicks's 10,000 Egyptian troops. Without a British army, it seemed impossible that Gordon should put down such a vastly superior force as that led by the Mahdi. But General Gordon felt duty-bound to rally to the support of Sudan in its time of crisis. And by the way, history would have been very different if he hadn't. He had just been offered by the King of the Belgians, King Leopold, to take command over the Congo, because Henry Morton Stanley, who is famous for having been the one who made David Livingstone so famous, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, and all of that. So this journalist and great explorer, Henry Morton Stanley, had been carving out civilization in the Congo and opening up posts and doing the most amazing work in suppressing the slave trade in the Congo. And he had pleaded for an officer to take control of the war against the slave trade in the Congo. And with Gordon's impeccable record of having put down the slave trade in Sudan, he was the best man for the job, and the King of the Belgians sought to recruit his services, and Queen Victoria gave her blessings, and General Gordon was off to the Congo. His bags were packed. He was ready to go to the Congo, and he would have become the Governor General of the Congo and would have done there what he had done in Sudan, put down the slave trade, built law and order and civilization. And how different things would have been in Sudan and Congo had that been so. But Gladstone managed to persuade King Leopold to suspend his offer so that he could relieve him of his obligations to the King of the Belgians and to rather go to Sudan. Appointed Governor General of Sudan and ordered to evacuate all foreigners, Gordon arrived to an enthusiastic welcome in Khartoum. He immediately halved taxes, abolished tax arrears, made a huge bonfire of tax records. He also announced the independence of Sudan from Egypt. He appointed himself a council to rule under himself as Commissioner of Her Majesty's Government. He then sought to have Britain declare Sudan its protectorate. Now, he had no authority for any of this. This is typical Gordon. He doesn't care what the British government wants to say. He goes ahead and does what he believes is right. And he was surrounded by the Mahdi's forces, so he reported that an evacuation was impossible and he requested a relief column. Gladstone had a fit. This is exactly what he feared, that Gordon wouldn't obey orders when he got there. Now, once the land routes were cut off and even the telegraph was cut, Gordon stopped being a politician and he concentrated on being a soldier, because now he couldn't communicate with the outside world anyway. And he brought immense reserves of courage and determination and invention into improving the defences of Khartoum. Khartoum, remember, is between the blue and the white now. He built a ditch to make it an island. A massive ditch, so made a moat effectively. And while negotiating with the Mahdi by letter, he strengthened the fortifications of Khartoum with a ditch, rampart, landmines, wire entanglements. He also abolished customs duties in the pass system at the gates of Khartoum to encourage villagers to bring more produce into market, which they did, which is essential, of course, to survive a siege. Gordon converted steamships into armoured warships with cannons, and these steamers were used for sorties to break up enemy concentrations, for raids to capture cattle, and excursions to buy grain. And Gordon's defence was very active, imaginative, aggressive. Gordon himself engaged in sharpshooting to take out enemy snipers, and as the siege tightened, artillery duels were fought with the Mahdi's forces. During all this time, a groundswell of public outrage was brewing in Britain. Newspaper editorials denounced the government's indecisiveness, evasiveness, and dishonesty. The Times called for prayers for General Gordon in imminent peril at Khartoum. Even Queen Victoria added her voice to the public demand for the British government to send a relief column. So Gladstone was frustrated and cursed the day that he had chosen someone like General Gordon to do this job. The outcry was perhaps motivated by humanitarian concern for the Sudanese people, commercial interest perhaps, admiration for Gordon's courage and dedication to duty. Certainly hatred for the slave trade was very strong in Victorian Britain. National pride was offended by being defeated by the dervishes, even though it was just a couple of British officers in charge of an Egyptian army. And of course there was evangelical missionary fervor who wanted to see Sudan won for Christ. So finally the British government felt compelled to send a relief column under General Wolseley, the good friend of General Gordon, but under such serious restrictions that they unnecessarily delayed their progress. Yes, Gladstone was a politician who dithered. Incredibly, several hundred of the Mahdi's soldiers deserted and came over to join Gordon's starving besieged garrison. What kind of soldiers would desert to join a besieged starving garrison? So Gordon was still attracting converts at that late stage. The British relief column smashed the Mahdi's forces of 10,000 dervishes at Abu Klay on the 17th of January 1885, causing much fear in the Mahdi's camp. Now, unfortunately, in a recent film called The Four Feathers, they depict the Battle of Abu Klay as a British defeat, where they were massacred, but that's completely false. Abu Klay was a great British victory. And in Four Feathers, they've got infantry at the Battle of Abu Klay, but in fact, there were Camel Corps. And there were 600 Camel Corps men, and although the dervishes broke into the British square, the square held. They managed to defeat the Mahdi's forces, and the Mahdi's forces retreated, and the Camel Corps continued on their advance. So how modern films can totally change history of the same event and just turn things on its head. Just after midnight at 26 January 1885, over 60,000 dervishes attacked Khartoum, swarming across the defences, overwhelming the thin line of starving, weakened troops. The Mahdists poured into Khartoum and they slaughtered both soldiers and unarmed civilians indiscriminately. There are two main accounts of Gordon's death. The first account to reach Cairo by one who never claimed to have been an eyewitness had Gordon calmly and unresistingly being speared to death. As this was the first version to be published, and as it's been immortalized in this famous Victorian painting, it's generally been accepted as the truth. However, there's two key eyewitness accounts, one by a bodyguard of Gordon, the other by a dervish warrior, who both agree that Gordon went down fighting. As the Mahdists broke into the palace garden, Gordon stopped them in their tracks with revolver fire from the upstairs. He then rushed to a wounded man's aid, was hit in the shoulder by a spear. The enemy came on again, he fired again till he ran out of ammunition, and then he lunged at them with a sword. A dervish shot him in the chest, knocking him back against the wall. He recovered again and with his sword beat back the enemy down the stairs. At this point he is felled with a spear thrust to his right side. Now you can take your choice as to whether you believe in the unresisting Gordon. This may accord with contemporary pacifist notions of a martyr, and he was treated as a martyr. But all his life Gordon had been a fighter. And so the way of evidence is that he didn't die as a lamb, but as a lion. 2 days later, the British relief column arrived. 2 days later. They had a whole year to reach him, and they took that long. The British public reacted with rage. The Queen sent a furious telegram to her Prime Minister, and by the way, that was the end of that government. They were voted out in the next opportunity. So, interesting, the Zulus brought down a government with the Battle of Isandlwana, and General Gordon brought down the government that replaced that government. Briefly, it was considered whether to press on and re-establish British prestige, but Gladstone's liberal views and his innate pacifism reassert themselves, and all British troops were withdrawn from Sudan. This is a press service being held at the Governor's Palace. You can see the steamboat behind and the Union Jacks above, but they've got Turkish flags. Technically, it was still part of Egypt, and Egypt was technically still part of Turkey, even though the British were running the whole show in Egypt at that stage. They managed to take Khartoum, and then they left it. And 6 months after Gordon's death, the Mahdi died, mysteriously. And a succession of poor harvests and epidemics and tribal wars reduced Sudan to misery. There was an attempted invasion of Egypt by the Mahdists in 1891, but that was soundly defeated by the British. In due course, with a conservative government in power in England, the time was chosen to avenge Gordon. Under General Kitchener, a vast Anglo-Egyptian army advanced up the Nile and crushed the Mahdists' army outside Omdurman. And some of you might have even read Winston Churchill's account, The River War, where he makes those interesting comments about Islam. But here you can see some depiction of the British lines, and they advanced next to the river, and so they had gunboats on the river that gave extra artillery support and, of course, ammunition resupply to the forces, because they were determined to be able to beat any Mahdist forces, and the Mahdists were slaughtered in great numbers, and it was a massive revenge for the killing of Gordon and for the massacre of people of Khartoum. On the whole, Sudan was the most successful and the most altruistic of all British colonial ventures, from which Britain gained very little and from which the Sudanese people benefited a great deal. Nowhere was the departure of the colonial power regretted more deeply than Gordon's Equatorial, and I've seen it. The people speak of the time when Britain ruled Sudan as their golden years. There's not a bad word that I've ever heard spoken about that. In fact, you go to Nigeria today and you go to Sudan and you only hear good words about the colonial time. I don't know whether it's because they're further north, they've had longer time of suffering under what's come since, but it used to be considered the premier appointment. If you were appointed as a civil servant or as a soldier to Sudan, it was a prestigious appointment that would guarantee high placement in the British civil service or army, because Sudan was a premier posting. It was a tough posting, but it was a posting that had tremendous prestige around it. And you actually can see that they took nothing out of Sudan. They put a lot into Sudan. And so when I've had people in Sudan who might talk about colonialism, Sudan was never a British colony. It was a protectorate. You know, it was a protectorate. They came here to end the slave trade, and the people have to back down and say that that's true. After independence, the statue of General Gordon was overturned by the Arabs, and there was a howl of protest even from older residents of Khartoum, saying, but he was a man of God. So this statue of Gordon no longer stands in Khartoum, even though the people on the ground may respect him. The leaders just hated everything he stood for. As with any great man, Gordon has received some vicious criticism from detractors who hate what he stood for and choose to assail his character. Now, some have depicted him as a drunkard. Yet no one ever saw him drunk. He did drink, but never in the field and never on safari, as he put it. He was reportedly never immoderate in his consumption of alcohol, and he also gave up alcohol regularly, even though in the film Khartoum they depict him endlessly asking for whiskey and soda, but that's just the Hollywood cliché. It's extremely improbable that he could have been a habitual drinker. At the cracking pace that he worked, with as little sleep as he had, in the harsh climates he travelled, and with as many enemies he had, neither his health nor his work nor his reputation in Sudan could have endured drink. Others have attempted to portray him as a homosexual. I've actually come across this, and this completely unsubstantiated slander is part of the homosexual community's strategy of claiming as many respected figures of the past as their own, in order to gain some respectability or way of association. For example, they recently brought out this disgusting film, Alexander, depicting Alexander the Great as some homo, even though he's married twice and he's a great soldier. And, you know, where on earth did he get this from? The fact that Gordon never married and that he devoted much of his time to rescuing orphaned boys from the streets is hardly evidence of homosexuality. Yet on this flimsy basis, there's been much speculation. But that's all it is. Speculation. But Gordon was a strict Victorian Christian gentleman who wrote scathingly against the effeminate. That's in his writings. He was appalled by the reprehensible sin of Sodom and Gomorrah, which is in his writings. Again, with all the many enemies he had, it is remarkable that not once in his 51 years did any one of his contemporaries suggest the slightest bit of scandal. The only scandal in Gordon's life during his lifetime was his disdain for money, that he was contemptuous of a room full of gold and of the Khedive's salary. Now, one criticism which is true is that Gordon had a fiery temper, and he did, and most leaders do, actually. He didn't tolerate incompetence, indolence, or dishonesty. He was a tiresome perfectionist, yet as he was quick to wound, so he was quick to apologize. He never lost his power to compel love, fear, and obedience from those around him. Remember, if you're a foreigner surrounded by others and you've got to be in a savage land and bring law and order, you've got to have the people fearing you too. He had his faults, but there's no doubt that General Gordon was a devout, sincere Christian, a courageous soldier, and a compassionate leader who cared for the poor and the helpless. And his legacy is still seen in Equatoria, where Christian soldiers strive to follow his courageous example by fighting for faith and freedom. There he's affectionately remembered as Gordon Basha. On my first trip to Equatoria, I was in this big parade ground, and I used an illustration of General Gordon. And my interpreter was a little perplexed. And, what do you mean? And I talked a bit more, and he suddenly said, "Ah, Gordon Pasha." And suddenly the whole parade ground erupted. "Ah, Gordon Pasha." And it was out of control for a long time as everyone was cheering and carrying on about Gordon Pasha before I could get back to the point. But it just shows they know him by that title, Gordon Pasha. Using Outram General Charles Gordon does not work. But he's greatly admired and respected and loved in Sudan to this day. Kush will submit herself to God. That is what the scriptures predict. And he had the joy of laying some solid foundations in Equatoria for the gospel. Shortly after Gordon's death, the Church of England started the Gordon Memorial Mission to Sudan. And many of the missionaries that started the work, in fact, our Bible college in Sudan at Mundri is called the Bishop Gwynne College. And Bishop Gwynne College is named after a missionary of the Gordon Memorial Mission to Sudan, a Church of England mission. And so tremendous amounts of things go on. Everything that I've related today on General Gordon is in a chapter in Faith Under Fire in Sudan book. He will soon be added to our Heroes of the Faith MP3s. It's important that we understand our history and the history of Sudan, and you can't understand the history of Sudan without understanding General Charles Gordon. And understanding the slave trade is vital to understanding the impact that he made in Sudan. It's all part of us understanding what's going on in our society. It makes sense when you know what Arab slavery is all about, what Christianity has done to oppose it. Then it puts the present Muslim Holocaust of Christians in perspective. And so I hope that this gives more ammunition as we are fighting against Islam, as we're working for Christian civilization, to know just one of these great heroes of the faith and what he did in order to fight for faith and freedom in Sudan. We'll have this up on the reformationsa.org website very quickly. Any comments or questions?
When he went to Sudan and he had nothing, just his own salary.
Yes.
Is that how you started?
Yes. It was a token appointment by the Khedive of Egypt. I've sent a Christian general to go and suppress slave trade. But all he's got is these useless, unmotivated Egyptian troops who've been sent there for punishment. And he had to, by his own force of personality, get things going. So it was an extraordinary thing. No resources, no army of his own from Britain.
Yeah,
but he achieved. He achieved it all.
He achieved it all right. But his name was probably... He was probably by then already Pasha, Gordon Pasha.
Oh, yes, that's their term of endearment.
Yeah, but it's still, to be said there was nothing and brought up an army by yourself and everything.
Yes, that is extraordinary. It's as incredible as Colonel Breitenbach going into Sudan, going into Angola and recruiting all these black Portuguese-speaking Angolan communists of the FNLA to come and fight for South Africa against the communists. An extraordinary achievement. There's one thing I left out, which is really amazing too. Before sailing for Egypt and Sudan, he asked, his last request to King Leopold of the Belgians was, if I fail to reestablish order in Khartoum, would you please take control over Equatoria and protect the people of Equatoria from the slave traders? And as a gentleman's agreement, the Belgians moved in and occupied Western Equatoria at that time. And I know this because the people there, we've got rows and rows and rows of mango trees all over in southern Sudan. And they were all planted by the Belgians, who were there during the time of General Gordon's demise and up till the time when the British came in 1898 finally and suppressed the slave trade and ended the Mahdi's rebellion. And when they finally came along, the Belgians said thank you and they marched back to Belgium, and Equatoria was handed over to the British. It was not even a gentleman's handshake, it was a verbal understanding. But extraordinary. There was a time that Equatoria was governed by the Belgians, and we still see some of the fruits of that today, literally. It's about the only fruit I get to eat in Sudan is mangoes. And There's even some buildings there, which that was built by the Belgians when they were there. I can't imagine that being done these days. You'd have governments doing anything except hand back something that they owned. Mm. But again, he was thinking of the people in Equatoria, his concern. I might die in Khartoum, but what's going to happen to the people in Equatoria? Yes. And so to protect the Bari and the Zandi and the Moro people over in Equatoria, he made an arrangement to the Belgians, and they stuck to that gentleman's agreement. Now, those sort of things are normally left out of most historical books. So when I'm working on our History of Africa book, I wanted to put in a lot of these Christian insights which don't normally see the light of day. It's not often that we get to focus on a military person directly, but he's an unusual case in that when have you ever had a British general who never commanded British soldiers?
Would you pick up here, please? Just bear with me. This Kush.
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 Yes.
I haven't come across it before.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the psalm here. But it says here, that is the Upper Nile region. Can you just elaborate on that for me?
Upper Nile would be Sudan. Now, now remember, if you're thinking upper, that's in elevation. So the source of the Nile, as was proved through the explorations in the 19th century, was Lake Victoria and other Great Lakes. And so that feeds the White Nile, which goes down. The White Nile is the longest river in the world. 4,000 kilometers, effectively, more than that. And so it takes 4 months for drop water to go from the Lake Victoria all the way through to the Mediterranean. Now, the Upper Nile would be that part where it's coming out of Uganda into southern Sudan. Southern Sudan, from us, might seem lower, but, of course, altitude is higher. And so lower Sudan would be close to Khartoum and closer to the to Egypt. So Upper Nile is effectively southern Sudan in terms of elevation.
This seems to be some sort of prophecy.
Yes.
The sentence.
The people of Sudan will come to Christ.
Yeah.
They'll submit to Christ, yes.
Yeah.
Kush will submit himself to God. I've got a chapter in Faith Under Fire in Sudan dealing with Bible prophecies about Kush. And it's actually quite extraordinary. It's a biblical people who get a lot more prophecies than most other countries in the world. Of course, you get a lot on Egypt, and you get a lot on Israel, and you get quite a lot in Babylon, and so on. But Kush is one of the areas that gets an extraordinary amount of mention. 60 different passages in the Bible refer to Kush, or Ethiopia, or the people of Kush.
Yeah.